Last week we examined Origen's method of interpreting the scriptures allegorically. We saw that he didn't develop strict criteria for testing his method, and also the philosophical background led him to an imbalance, concentrating on the divinity of the Word rather than the humanity of Jesus. The imbalance was corrected, I believe, particularly by a man called Lucian, who was teaching in Antioch, where the church community were first called Christians, you know, in Syria, north of Jerusalem there. And in about the year 270, we don't have the exact date, but anyhow, in the last third of that third century, he set up what could be called a rival school in Antioch. He didn't set it up to rival Alexandria, but he himself was a famous linguist. In fact, he edited the critical edition of the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. He did the second edition. He was a brilliant scholar of language and a master of it. And he insisted, and you probably guessed this would be the direction we'd have to go in anyhow, that yes, the scriptures, he understood the symbolic significance of words. He understood, as very few around him understood, the literary forms of the Hebrew mind and imagination. But he insisted that meanings had to be established from the text. And he went back to the actual meaning of words. What does this Greek word mean in the early part of the first century, for example? Literary analysis of the actual text and the structure of the text, historical analysis, seeing it in its setting and so on. A very modern approach, we would might say, and here it is right back in the middle of the third century. He was a linguist and a man aware of grammar, context and so on. That is the key balance one needs to the movement in Alexandria. In fact, I think today, scriptural scholarship really follows those two lines, basically, with a lot of refinements. An Alexandrian anti-fundamentalist approach, an awareness of the need for imagery and symbolic language, with, however, a need to go back to the text and base your interpretations right there in the script. Well, what happened? Two things. This is an interpretation of history, of course, and it's, I don't put it forward as true, I put it forward as the best understanding I have of it. Two things happened. It meant that in Antioch, unlike Alexandria, there was a lot of concentration on the humanity of Jesus. Unavoidably, because they were analysing the text, and anyone who picks up the gospel text becomes terribly aware of Jesus' humanity. So the Antioch school became, for centuries, a school where the humanity of Jesus was right there in the forefront of their mind and understanding. And that actually was a wonderful thing. Now, a historical accident, I think it was an accident, it may have been some fault in Lucian's teaching, a bit much to be sure about. The sad thing, in a way, was that Lucian's students, at any rate, whether he was at fault or not, who knows, I don't think anyone knows, but one of his most famous students was Arius, and you may have heard of the Arian heresy. And another one of his students was, we're going to meet a couple of times today, was a man called Eusebius, who became bishop of Nicomedia, which was the imperial diocese in the Eastern Empire. A man of incredible political power. In fact, he was the one who baptized Constantine on his deathbed. So he had an in with the emperor, which proved to be disastrous to the church. Now, these two students of Lucian, with their concentration on the humanity of Jesus, well, particularly Arius, we're going to see, went into a heresy which was going to break the Eastern Church apart for a century, and the church in the West, through the conversion of the Goths, were going to suffer from the Arian heresy for 250 years. So we're right in the same key question we're asking today: who is Jesus? So I need to set up the scene for you to examine Arius and then to see how the church handled the Arian heresy. That's my aim in this first part of tonight's lecture. Let's look at Arius and then see how the church came to terms with it. Arius, while he was a student of Lucian of Antioch, was actually a priest in Alexandria. And when the followers of Sabellius were saying, in their way of interpreting the scriptures and handing on the faith, that actually the Son and the Father were actually identical, there's only one God, one person, one being, and the Son and the Father are the same, and off they went. This Arius, who was apparently a very popular preacher, we don't have many of his writings, and the ones we do have are little ditties. He was good at putting up slogans and writing on graffiti on walls and getting the laity kind of singing in church type of thing. He was a bit of a, you know, that style of person, and not a very clear thinker with all that. Well, he was upset by this total disrespect of the Gospels, making Jesus kind of unreal in a way. His body and his humanity unreal, because if you identify him with the Father, well then what on earth is this human body wandering around the place doing? So he opposed that with vigour and clarity, as he thought, and had a great following. But the logic of what he was saying, and the bishop, Alexander, his name, of Alexandria, had it brought him in, and they debated this thing, but Arius wouldn't shift. And so he eventually had to excommunicate Arius, and that caused further problems and so on. And this is going to set the scene for the First Council of the Church of Nicaea. Well, he claimed, in effect, that the Logos, I'll give you a reading in a moment, was really a creature. Though he kept saying divine, you know, without really saying God. He kept shifting his words, but in effect, that's what he was claiming. He says, yes, of course, Jesus was perfect. He was unique. He wasn't just one other creature. He was deified in some way. He was divine in some way. He used all of those kind of words. But he had the Platonic God in his head anyhow, which is half the problem with all these debates. The God who is the idea, the supreme idea of the good, and has no real connection with creation. No way of connecting. Because that would demand some change in God. If God creates the world, well, then God didn't create the world, and then God did create the world, so God must have changed, if you follow the logic of all that. And God can't change, theoretically. So they were caught in this faulty philosophy, faulty thinking. So he was caught in it too. So he had a break between God and not God. And in that break, across that gulf, where does the Logos go on the not God side of that chasm? He was created from nothing, he claimed. Created, you might recall in your Nicene Creed, begotten, not made. We say it every Sunday. Begotten, not created, not made. And he also had a famous slogan, there was a time when he was not, was his way of putting it. When you think of the incarnation, Jesus in the womb of Mary, obviously 2 years before Mary wasn't pregnant, so there was a time when Jesus was not, wasn't there? If you take my simple, obvious, transparent meaning of that. Well, Jesus is the Word, and he wasn't saying that was the time, but there was a time right back at the beginning when the Word was not. Now, jumping ahead, but I will now go on to explain it, that statement was condemned at the First Council of the Church at Nicaea. And that council itself, as we will see later tonight, was consolidated and restated at a later council in the church. So insofar as you or I believe in the providence of God, in the faith of a community, in the constant teaching of a subject that wasn't by default, it was really the way they were attending, insofar as we have any confidence in that movement of belief within the community, we can confidently say that the church rejects Arius's view. Whatever the truth is, that isn't true. That's error. That's a misunderstanding of the revelation and the meaning of Jesus as it comes to us through our community of faith. In fact, that was their main argument. That whatever of the theory, and He was a great debater, Arius. The bishop wasn't. The bishop was, I guess, like most bishops, doing his best to love people and organise the place and keep people happy and make the next decision and whatever you've got to do, build a church or whatever the practical decisions that face practical men are. He wasn't. But Arius was a great debater. And one of the things that happened at this time of the church was that up till then, the church had been very delicate. We saw it already in Clement last week, about talking publicly about the mysteries of faith, because beautiful things can only be talked about in a beautiful setting. And in when people are going to scoff at religion, that's not what it's about. People are going to scoff at love, we'll talk about something else. If they're going to rubbish Beethoven's music, we'll play it somewhere else. I mean, beautiful things can easily be dragged down, can't they? What is it? Don't throw your pearls before swine, that kind of. So they used to, religion was considered, you had to be very well advanced into the church. Even catechumens, you might find this hard to believe, but it's true, right into the second century, you didn't know the Our Father till the day of your baptism. The prayer, the Our Father, even a catechumen didn't know it. And it was a carefully guarded secret, you might say. A carefully guarded prayer, because the church didn't want everybody saying Our Father without realising, good God, what am I saying? They wanted them to say it only with faith. Which says a lot about catechesis, I think, too. We've got a lot to learn from the church in one way. But anyhow, this man, Arius, was the main one who blew that, because he went public and went out and had people laughing and singing his ditties, and that posed an enormous problem. So the church had to come out, and I guess it's the only way forward. So you have this public expose of the delicate mysteries of faith. Well, the fact is, the faithful, ordinary mums and dads, did worship Jesus as God. Their religious experience that was attached to God was attached to Jesus. In fact, whatever one talks about religious experience, and I know it can be distorted as well as directed well, the universal practice, and they kept saying that, this is not what our people do. It's not what our people believe. It's not the tradition. It's not what happens to us in the Christian community. They claimed also, in the notes that are behind the council, that what Arius was doing was really cutting across three critical religious experiences that we would call Christian. One was the very revelation that if Jesus was simply not God, but some kind of prophet of God, then to actually see Jesus is not to see God. It's to see a prophet of God, but not God. So you're still caught, no matter how beautiful Jesus might be, and he is, you're still left with a question, yes, but what is God like? If Jesus isn't God, eh? And the church had always sensed that in seeing Jesus, we were actually looking on the face of God. That to know Jesus is to know God. If you know me, you know my Father, Philip. You know that Johannine text. Secondly, the whole thing of redemption, being really redeemed. Redeemed, liberated, and that is what liberates us. The only ultimate Christian liberation is to know who God is. And still a major problem, isn't it? How we give God such a bad press. But to know God is redemption, because if God is the God that Jesus speaks about, then all that Moses ever dreamed or hoped for becomes very real, and it's universal, it's Catholic, it's for the whole world. There are marvellous things being said. But if Jesus is not God, you take the logic of it, then Jesus' thoughts aren't necessarily God's thoughts, no matter how we might like to link them. And finally, Arius was actually cutting the ground from underneath any communion with God. He was effectively saying you can have no communion with God. God can have no communion with the creature, because God is transcendent, utterly unknowable, and there can be no contact between God and not God. And yet, kids, uncles, mum and dad, martyrs, confessors of the faith, beautiful, saintly, struggling human people, experienced communion with God, they experienced a redemption in their life, and they experienced a revelation of God, and the church was protecting that mystery. one only reading from Arius. We haven't got many, so ones. This is actually, we've only got this because it's contained in a later book written by Athanasius. I suppose 30 years later, he's got this statement, and it's a letter that Arius wrote to the bishop at the time of the debate in 318 AD. And the letter reads and gives us some idea of Arius's position. This one God, says Arius, before all time begot his only begotten Son, through whom he made the universe. He made his Son to subsist, and he made him unchangeable. The divine Logos. God's perfect creature, he is unlike any other creature, begotten, but unique in the manner of his begetting. There are three hypostases. Come back, that's the Greek word I've put in there, I don't want to translate it. Substances would be a reasonable English word. But God, who is the cause of all things, is absolutely the only one who is without beginning. The Son did not exist before he was begotten. I hope not waiting for me to give any understanding of that particular statement. It's very highfalutin language, isn't it? And one could get every word and find it, but at least looking at it superficially and not pretending to get right into it, granted Arius stirred the church and granted he was opposed, one can presume that in there was something claiming that he was a creature, that there was a time that he existed before he was begotten. All of it is dangerously removing the Logos from our understanding of the eternal God. I guess you can pick up at least the danger of that, though the words are tortuous, and no doubt you can interpret them nearly any way you like.